You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is episode 87, and this is Jason. And today I've got I'm calling you a recurring guest now. Matthew Evans is joining for this episode as we're going to be discussing the question, a very relevant question, really, just in light of the central place that science and scientific thinking has in American culture and just Americans in general. We put a lot of stock in what scientists say, and there's good and bad that comes with that. They're very, they're in a very authoritative position, I'll say that, in the culture. But what we want to talk about specifically today is evolution. And we're talking about Darwinian evolution, molecules to man evolution. And the question we want to ask is, could God, specifically the God of the Bible, could God have used evolution to create? Is there any reason why God couldn't, based on what we know of him, based on what we see in the text? Because the reality is, evolution, and I think you would agree with me on this, Matt, evolution is everywhere in the sense that we are fed it from the moment it seems like we come into this world. We're constantly seeing it on the Discovery Channel, National Geographic. It's just the assumed belief system that is part of our culture, although there is a strong undercurrent that opposes Darwinian evolution. In the mainstream media and in mainstream education, mainstream universities, this is the assumed doctrine that Darwin, in essence, got it right, and that man was not specially and uniquely created, but that we are here as a result of a very long and unguided and ultimately random process, biological process, whereby starting with tiny one-celled organisms, unicellular organisms, over time through adaption, mutation, and natural selection, these new organisms came about, and Darwin even kind of spelled it out as the tree of life, where there's one root, one starting point, and that all of organic life on Earth is actually related biologically. So that's what we're going to be looking at. And before I go any further, I want to say, Matt, thank you for joining on the podcast.
Thank you.
And Matt, I always enjoy talking with you about this kind of stuff. You've got a great perspective on, I think, just science and faith and that intersection. So maybe real quick, before we get into the meat of this, could you just share just a little bit about why you think it's good to talk about the intersection of science and faith?
Yeah, I think it's so important. I mean, it's important in my life personally because I was taught evolution and I suppose I believed it, but it wasn't necessarily something that I focused my entire life on. But in coming to faith, I kind of have been able to look more closely at it and realize that it doesn't make sense scientifically, and that God's word is true to how life is created. As you were saying, that as Frank Turek puts it, it's goo to the zoo to you.
Right. Yeah. Like, goo to you via the zoo. Yeah.
Yeah. That's correct. So, I mean, one of the biggest problems with Darwinism, you could argue a lot of things after that first moment, but that has to be addressed first.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did that first life come from? That's a huge one. And really, I mean, that's part of all this, because when you think about it, like evolution, we typically think of Darwinian biological evolution, but really you've got to push it back and look at chemical evolution, like how did the right elements come to be, and then before that, even stellar evolution. But the same story goes that it was an unguided process. So let's look at this first from Scripture. I think it's always good to begin with the Bible, and we want to do that on this podcast consistently. But based on Scripture, and I'm talking about especially Genesis, but we see this even in other passages in the Bible, can evolution even fit? And we'll look at this first biblically from the Bible's perspective, then we'll look at this from a scientific perspective and some of the questions that will come up there in science, and then we'll finish off by looking at this question from a theological perspective. So starting off biblically, is there a reason from the Bible itself? Let's start with Genesis 1. Can we fit evolution into that?
I think just looking at it, that the way it was created would not account for that. And I think over and over again, reading the Bible, I've noticed that God anticipates these things coming out in our world, the beginning of time, realizing that there was an order to creation, as well as specific ways he made creation, as well as specifically mentioning that each species begets from each other, so that there wouldn't be there's obviously speciation, there's difference in animals, of course, like different dog breeds, but they're still in the dog kind, so it fits with Genesis. But with Darwinian evolution, it has a species can become another species, which is not something we observe, and it's not something we observe from Genesis happening.
Well, you're right. I mean, looking at just like the order of creation, it seems like there's a message there so clearly that God's trying to tell us that this wasn't a random sort of haphazard process. This was very orderly. There's 6 days. I mean, we're told what happens on each specific day. And the fact that, as you brought up, the repeated refrain there is, and he created them each according to their kind, each according to their kind. And just thinking about us from God's perspective, if you will, if God wanted to teach us evolution, if he wanted us to get any even like a primitive, you know, version of evolution so that people, you know, in the pre-scientific era could understand this or grasp this, would it make any sense at all to say it in that way, that they were to produce each after their own kind? That's the big thing for me is the Bible seems to be telling us so forthrightly and so clearly that it was a direct creation, that specific kinds. And of course, species and kinds do vary. There's a difference between a species and a kind. I think kind is much broader than a species. But nonetheless, there's change within a kind, but you never see a kind changing into another kind. And that's what's taught in Scripture itself.
Yeah, and I think I was looking at Dr. Chen, who Stephen Meyer brings up, mentioned how so Darwin had the tree of life that you mentioned earlier, with you have the universal common descent, and then it branches out into like what would look like a tree of every living being on the planet. But he came back and said the tree is actually the other way around. It goes, you know, up, it's upside down, looking at the genetics, which points again to you have all these specific animal kinds being created with the information in them. So when they, you know, when they procreate, you know, it's dispersing, and it fits more with Genesis when they look at it rather than the way Darwin had it, which would cause lots of problems because the way Darwin looked at it, it was that they keep advancing or progressing, which is a word that's used, progress, which is an interesting word, which seems to mean to an evolutionist that things are getting better or in some way like almost morally better or perfect, but yeah, that doesn't fit. There's no reason to use the word progress. So I don't know. That's kind of an interesting verbiage that's used to make it look like the branch that we're going in a direction, which would be part of what makes, I think, evolution so, I don't know, enticing.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, I have heard, and what we want to acknowledge is that there are genuine Christian Bible scholars who hold to evolution, and that's why this question becomes important, because they are, in essence, arguing that no, God did do it this way, and that we've been misinterpreting, the church has misinterpreted Genesis and the creation story for centuries. That's what it comes down to, is that we finally got it right, thanks to our scientific advancements and our understanding of Darwinian evolution. We finally got it right. And I guess the allegorical interpretation, or however you want to put it, the metaphorical interpretation of Genesis, to me, the big problem right there is that Hebrew poetry, and by that I mean times where you see, like in the Psalms, where metaphor or I wouldn't say alliteration, but also similes are employed. You know, those images that represent something else, essentially. That metaphorical language is always marked by a few traits in Hebrew poetry. One would be Hebrew parallelism. Another would be a certain version of the Hebrew verb that doesn't show up in historical narrative. And so the text itself seems to be pushing us in the direction of, this is a historical narrative. It's a sober account. You don't see, you really, like you pointed out, it's so orderly. You don't see any exaggerations or any like hyperbole. There's nothing about the gods warring like you got in the Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian account of creation. You don't see one dragon, swallowing up the sea, or things involving a massive tortoise or anything like that. This is just a straightforward account telling us how it happened. So that gives me reason to believe this is meant to be historical and read as what actually happened.
I think that's a good point, that when the Bible is being scientific, it's being scientific, and when it's being using other similes and figures of speech, that's when we can, those are usually pretty obvious. But the orderliness and the process, I think that's something that needs to be looked at, is when God creates, there's an order, there's a process, there's a design to it. And again, Crick and Watson discovered DNA. That was what they found, was design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly fits with the biblical model. Now, so my, I guess you could say it's a challenge, or it's just an encouragement for anybody who has been taught evolution, has sort of imbibed it along with a lot of other studies and teachings out there, and you're a Christian, or at least you take the Bible seriously. I would encourage you to just read through Genesis 1 through 3 in particular, but even beyond that, Genesis 1 through 11, and just ask yourself, is there any way that the ultimate author, God, or even the human author, Moses, intended, is there any way to interpret this in a way that they intended to teach evolution of any kind? And I've even heard, I want to address this real quick before we go into the scientific problems with evolution. I've even heard theistic evolutionists bring up the passage in Genesis 2 where it says that man was formed from the dust of the ground, and that's when God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. I've read that this is a picture of man coming from the already existing organisms. He's coming from the dust of the ground, so to speak. Okay, but there's a huge problem baked into the narrative itself with that interpretation, and that is that after Adam and Eve sinned, We all know God cursed the ground, but more than that, he cursed man because he said, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. So if we're going to be consistent, then we would have to say that if the dust in Genesis 2 represents pre-existing animals from which man came, then that would mean that the curse, the punishment for sin, is that we would return to being ape-like creatures. And I don't think anyone is going to be arguing for that as the punishment God is talking about. So that what I'm pushing for is consistency here. If we're going to say this is poetic, we've got to say the whole thing is poetic. And then we've got to ask, okay, why come to Genesis 12 and suddenly say, okay, now we're reading genuine history about Abraham? Why the break? Because the same vav consecutive Hebrew word is used throughout. There's no jump from Hebrew parallelism or poetic language to suddenly historical language. It's all the same narratival type. So you'd have to make a case for why you hold that, if that is just from the Bible. You'd have to make a case for why it's different. Okay, so let's jump to scientific problems with evolution. So Matt, just in the, you know, we're non-scientists, but we are students of science. We love reading about science and learning science. What do you see that's some of the major problems with the theory from a scientific perspective?
Yes, and I agree. We are not, well, I'm not a scientist, but
neither of us.
Yeah, but having just studied it a little bit, there's, I feel like, some pretty noticeable issues that have been brought up by other scientists that are incredibly important. One of the main ones too is that Darwin said, if in the future we find that life is more complex than we now know, like the cell, that could be kind of the death blow to his theory. So he thought the cell was more of like a protoplasm, like a very simplistic thing, and we've learned more about it. So that has changed the whole, with more knowledge, we know more about how life, the incredible design of the cell, which has led to DNA, which has led to information sciences, which has led to realizing that it had to be created, because the only thing we know that creates is a mind, and languages are like a software code, which is what DNA is like. So that has pointed more towards a creator rather than the way evolution looks at it, and also just how life came about altogether, which we haven't. We have no other explanation for where everything came from, which is huge. Also, there's the issue with historical science, where you have to look back in time and basically say that things were different back then. So evolution uses time a lot, kind of as a evolution of the gaps scenario, where they use, and in fact, actually I was watching a YouTube where a scientist mentioned that think of endless amounts of time to create, for evolution to work. Well, we don't have endless amounts of time, and that's not, that isn't scientifically accurate. So some of the wording is problematic, because just putting together how things, if you say time is the thing that is creating things, time doesn't do that, for one.
Mm, yeah.
In fact, time actually is a problem for evolution.
Yeah. Well, explain a little bit more what you mean by that, because I think I know where you might be going, but explain how time is a problem.
Well, basically, based on like on entropy, you have, when you try to, let's say, manufacture life or a system, time will actually like wear it down and will not allow it to, for the, what you want to take place.
Mm-hmm.
The more time you give it, the harder things are going to break down, rather than, again, if you left your car in a field for years, it will break down. It won't become a better car or more advanced. And that's also true with biology.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just the kind of the way of the world. The second law of thermodynamics, things break down. We don't see in a naturally, we don't see natural causes like hurricanes, tornadoes, for example, volcanoes erupting. They tend to break things down, and there seems to be no positive improvements. We don't see any like increases in complexity simply because of natural processes, and that's a huge problem for evolution. There is something I think something we probably should maybe a myth we should dispel is that creationists like ourselves don't believe that organisms can adapt, and that is a very common straw man that I hear all the time, really, that, you know, creationists believe we're all the organisms are just stationary, static species where they don't adapt, they don't change over time at all, and then, you know, they bring forward the argument with Darwin's finches. And it's knocked down flat, right? Because obviously there was a fair amount of variation within the beak sizes for these finches that Darwin talked about and that are so widely recognized in the Darwinian literature. But the fact is, we do believe that there's a lot of variation, and it's only because there was a God who put so much variability and genetic variability and ability to adapt to different environments within the genetic code that this could happen. But what we don't see, and this is just observational science, what we don't see is new genetic information being added to organisms' genetic code. And by new genetic information, I mean that for evolution to happen, there has to be built into the DNA of an organism, there has to be new instructions for how to build new organs or new anatomical structures like the eye or the brain, things like that. There has to be that built into the DNA. But what we don't see in adaptation or mutation, either one of those, we don't see new genetic information coming about. What we see is a rearrangement of the already existing genetic information. So that's the big thing that we need to see, because Darwin's finches, I mean, in any other scenario, creationists would be fully on board and saying, look, this is amazing how God designed these finches to adapt to different environments. That proves God is an intelligent designer behind all this. But because they've been sort of commandeered by evolutionists as examples of evolution, we think of that as maybe this is something that we don't know about. But adaptation, and even in fact the term natural selection was first invented, that whole concept was invented by a creationist, Edward Blythe, several years before Darwin wrote his book on the Origin of Species. So to think of natural selection or adaptation to different environments as a strictly Darwinian idea to begin with is wrong. It's just like that may have been something where you've gathered over time where you make that association. But if you're listening to this and you've thought of natural selection as an evolutionary idea or a Darwinian idea, it's not. It's a part of creation. It's something that the designer built into the fabric of his world. But what we see is there's always limits. And this is something Michael Behe, the biochemist from Lehigh University, talks about. There's always limits to evolution. You don't see a dog become a horse. You don't see a duck become an ostrich or anything of that nature. A duck can only get so big. Its bill can only get so long. And then there's an edge. That's what Behe talks about, is the edge of evolution. There's a limit to how much mutation and adaptation can happen within a specific kind. Or he might call it phyla or something along those lines, but essentially we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, it was interesting. In Michael Behe's book, Darwin Devolved, he talks about the finches. There was a couple that studied the Finches for 10 years. And after 10 years, the Finches were still Finches. As well as, he makes the point that when they're studying the beak sizes and the other small variations over generations, they happen really quickly. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like a gradual, like one family of Finches' beaks gets longer slowly. It was like really quick, like one is really long and then one's really short. And so what they're realizing was if evolution is happening, it's happening far too quickly to fit Darwin's mechanism for evolution. And that was kind of like what you were saying with adaptation. It seemed to be, they realized that adaptation was a real thing, but not the slow progression to something else. And again, the Finches remain Finches. And of course, a Finch can only mate with another Finch, basically, you know, like, or an animal of its kind at least. So you don't really have that, like, there's no way it's going to become something else.
Yeah. And because Darwin's Finches is just such a classic example, put forward as if it's an example of Darwinian evolution, it's worth pointing out that, like you said, they always remained Finches. And also that there was a couple, I can't think of their name right now, but there was a couple that actually went to the Galapagos Islands and studied the Finches. I think it was the same islands that he went to originally. In any case, they studied the Finches that Darwin described, and what they found was that there was cyclical variation. So in other words, when the climate made it so that smaller seeds became available, there was more smaller seeds available for these Finches, the beak size actually tended to be smaller. And then later, over cyclical variation, if the seeds ended up being bigger that were available, their beaks got bigger. But what happened was they always reverted to the mean. They talk about that reversion to a mean where you don't see it, you know, like think of a parabola. You go to a certain limit and then you start coming back to the center. And that's how it tends to happen. But creationists are the leading creationists out there. If you just read their literature, they'll tell you there are a lot more genetic relationships than I think Darwinians would want to frame it as. For instance, like the polar bear, the grizzly bear, the black bear, all came from one original pair, and that's the genetic information was there from the beginning. But as they went out to different climates, different environments, certain traits were expressed, which makes sense. That's what God did when He designed these animals. He gave them that adaptability. It's why we can see that with artificial selection when it comes to dog breeding or sheep breeding or cattle breeding. There's always going to be limits. You can only make a cow so big, and even with steroids, I'm telling you, there's a limit to how big you can make that cow. And that's something that creationists have long held to. It's not a new idea that this adaptation can happen.
Yeah, it's kind of like with information systems, you have, like, say you'd have a sentence like, Mary went to the house and had tea. That's the first sentence. But if you add a letter, like, Mary went to the houses and had tea, something like that, adding the letter takes it from the design, and it changes the meaning, but it doesn't help necessarily the structure of the meaning. You can always... Meaning, like, when evolutionists talk about, like, well, you know, a fly or a bird didn't have a wing at first, but then slowly they had something that was almost a wing, and then they had something that was almost even closer to a wing, and then finally became one. That's not how it works for several reasons, because you need a whole system, a whole, like you said, was it taxonomical or phenotypic design to create that. It can't come by gradually.
Right.
And when you look at genes and different species, you see that there's an original, basically, and then there's the progeny of that original. And abnormalities can come, but there's, like you said, it always will cycle back to something similar to, you know, the original.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously a big question that's got to be looming for somebody who's long held to evolution and is listening to this is, okay, but why would it be so widely accepted? And why does it seem like when the evidence of like the moths changing color or the finch beaks and all these other icons of evolution, if these don't prove the theory, then why are they always touted as proof? And that's a fair question. I mean, we've all seen the ape to human progression, and what we got to remember is so much of the theory and the basis for accepting the theory is based on assumptions. Because when you look at even like the steps of apes to man, for example, there haven't actually been missing links discovered. They're hypothetical. The only way for evolution, Darwinian evolution, to be true is they have to be out there. So they have to hypothesize that they just need to be discovered, or if not, then no fossils were ever formed. But the assumption is that it's true, and we just got to find the evidence to support it. But if we would take it a step back and say, now wait a second, what is the evidence itself actually say, then we come away with a different scenario where Darwinian evolution can't be true for a number of reasons. When I think of the ape to human evolution, for example, Matt, this is often touted as the great find, right? That Lucy, the Australopithecus afarensis species, Lucy was an ape. But the amazing thing is that it's touted as this this precursor, or that, you know, this precursor to hominids, or this early precursor to Homo sapiens. But the problems begin when you look at what we actually see. So if you go to a museum, natural science museum, that has a Lucy model on display, almost always you're going to see something that's very incorrect, and that's that the hands and the feet look much more human than the actual fossils of Australopithecus afarensis that have been found, and this is something where you'd have to look at books like Bones of Contention by Marvin Lubinow and others, where he documents how in reality, the Australopithecus afarensis is very similar to a pygmy chimpanzee, and the hands and feet of that fossil that have been found were curved and long fingered, like apes. It was not at all like a human. So when you see it represented like that in the museum, it's just plain wrong. It's not just that they're maybe obscuring some of the facts. They're actually representing the length of those hands and feet wrongly, and to make them look more human. But there's some big problems that Lubinow talks about in his book. Like, for instance, every time we see a supposed ape man put forward, it breaks down. Either it's a fully ape specimen or it's a fully human specimen. Take the Piltdown Man as an example. Now get this, for 50 years, this mainstream scientific community accepted Piltdown Man as a transitional species between apes and humans. Okay, but after 50 years, it was proven, and it's no longer accepted, by the way, it's totally seen as a hoax. It was proven that it was nothing but an orangutan jaw and a human skull put together. Now, the amazing thing is just think about how the lengths that people have to go to and what this tells us about the evidence that's actually there. But the teeth of this orangutan jaw had been filed down so that you could even see the pulp chamber that was exposed and then filled in to hide what they had done. And after this was discovered, you know, even one of the leading authorities of so-called human evolution, Solly Zuckerman, said, "It's doubtful there is any science at all in the search for man's fossil ancestry." That's the leading authority at the time when this came out, because so much of the so-called fossil evidence that says, look at these fossil hominids that are obvious precursors, they're actually either apes or humans. And there's been this massive problem with the way that these fossils have been looked at from the beginning.
Yeah, it is interesting how many hoaxes there are and that are still out there, like the peppered moths that were put on the tree that actually those moths actually don't go that far down the tree, but they found some dead ones and then they pinned it next to one that was, like, I guess peppered, that's correct, and then, or vice versa, and then took a picture as evidence, you know. And there's, yeah, and there's quite a few of those. There's the artist, I forget the artist's name, but he tried to show how in the embryo, every creature is basically the same, and then it kind of evolves in the womb, basically, or the egg, Ernst, or what have you, and then it...
Ernst Haeckel.
Yeah, and then... What's that?
Ernst Haeckel. Was it?
Yes, yes. And how that was just artist rendition or whatever, that it was a complete hoax scientifically. And but these are still, you know, out there for people to look at. Like you said, too, the ape to man, or, you know, those, that evolution picture is just a, it's not scientific. It's just,
yeah,
it looks scientific, but it's, you know, it's not based on science at all.
Or like Nebraska Man, it was all based on a single tooth that ended up being a pig's tooth. I mean, so you just, yes, you look at that and you got to say, if that is what they're coming up with, if that's what they have come up with after all this time looking for fossils, then they've got to be pretty desperate. They've got to, that tells you something about what the evidence actually points to, and it's not in favor of Darwinian evolution. So because we got to wrap up, I just want to move on. We could talk probably much longer about the scientific evidence and the problems we see there with evolution, but I want to talk about the theological problems with evolution. Here's the big thing. To say that you're a theistic evolutionist by the Darwinian literature as a standard itself, theistic evolution is an oxymoron. And the reason why I say it's an oxymoron is because evolution is always described as this unguided, undirected process that does not involve an intelligent designer or intelligence of any kind. And so when you put that word theistic in front of it, it may feel good to say, well, God was involved with this, but the biologists and the astronomers and the paleontologists, paleoanthropologists, all of those who take a Darwinian perspective are going to say, no, God didn't do this. This was a purely natural process. And so essentially, what it comes down to is you've got to choose one camp or the other, because both camps are saying that either it involved God or it didn't. But there's no halfway version of evolution that says, well, God maybe partly inserted himself to make this happen. No science textbook, no scientists from the Darwinian camp are going to make that argument. But I see some other problems, Matt, and the big problem with the God of theistic evolution is that if God did use evolution, that implies that God had to rely on death, because there's only death and selective survival. That's what happens to create this vast number of various species we see today. So God had to have death baked into his world from the beginning. And the only way he could create was through death.
And I was just thinking about that today, that the mover, if you will, in evolution is death, or, you know, destroying a species before it can procreate or what have you. And that's the prime mover for evolution, which, you know, again, is used so much in our culture that it can mean so many different things. It can mean progress. It can mean whatever. But it definitely changes the whole
like what creation actually is and God's nature. And I would argue even that evolutionists do at least posit some sort of deistic, like, or not deistic God really, but like some sort of God that does do some sort of miracle or does affect things. Like you just said, it could be that this mover is just death deciding who lives and dies. And it definitely, like you said, it would change the whole nature of creation and how that works.
Right. Yeah. And you would, if theistic evolution is true, then you can't look at a rabbit and say, God created that rabbit as a rabbit. You know, this is part of his handiwork, or a deer. He didn't create the deer as a deer. No, you'd have to say he used myriads, and I mean myriads of intermediate species that had to adapt, evolve, and then die off before he could create, if you can even use the word create, the creatures we see today. So that's a God who cannot create apart from death. And I'm just going to ask you, does that even remotely sound like the God who calls death the last enemy, who came to defeat death, who in the when all things are restored, we're going to see the lion and the lamb lying down next to each other. There's going to be total restoration to the animal world, not just to our bodies and not just to our lives, but to the animal world itself, talks about in Isaiah. So we have to say, is this God of theistic evolution even recognizable in the Bible? And my conclusion, I think both of our conclusions would have to be, no, he's not. You're having to distort parts of scripture that just don't represent, in a way that it doesn't represent the God of the Bible anymore.
Right. And taking Darwinism to the next step, which many scientists might not, or necessarily, but philosophically, Darwinism would be a naturalistic belief system, which, if you're a naturalist, then even if you're right, you're wrong, because everything would have come from nothing, and therefore goes to nothing. So there's really, not only is that even logically impossible, but everything that is meaningless under that framework. So you have a whole different, they don't teach you that in school, but if you draw it out to its natural conclusion, you'll get to that point. And I think, you know, I was thinking, I wrote down, like, Stalin, for instance, would be a terrible fruit of a Darwinian point of view, as well as any other. But it's not only as simple as science. I don't think Christianity has taught on that evolution is a theory that has scientific, even in a really scientific sense. So take it down, you have social Darwinism as well. So all of that is something to be wary of as well, but starting with the science, or starting with even reality, starting with like where did it all come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
God clearly, you know, as it says in Psalms, you know, that, his handiwork is clear to everyone. So just to look at it, you know, you don't have to look in a microscope or a telescope to realize that we're in a creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.